Shabbat Shalom, everyone. It is great to be gathered together. And as you can see, today we're going to have a veggie tale. Well, sort of, not really. But the story of the book of Esther has been made into a veggie tale in order to teach kids a valuable lesson. And last week on Friday night, as we began to enjoy our Sabbath, several of us gathered together to watch a movie that was done by some Christian folks to attempt to tell the story of Esther. I forgot to set my recording, so we'll do that now. Okay. So anyway, after we had watched that movie, I forget who put it together. It wasn't a veggie tale, but it was just a regular movie. It's called The Book of Esther. Sherilyn made the comment after it was over that while it was cool to see the story kind of played out, she commented that they kind of missed the mark in really explaining any or bringing out any of the spiritual lessons from the book. And that really the veggie tale, even though it was historically completely inaccurate, did a much better job of actually delivering at least one of the lessons from the book. I had to agree. And it made me remember that a long time ago I had been thinking about the book of Esther and wanted to give a sermon on it because I thought it would be a good message, and I just really never got around to it. Though it seemed like there was more pressing things to cover. So today I'm going to take a shot at it. I'm going to take a shot at telling the story of the book of Esther. Esther is easy to find. You just go to Psalms and go back two books, and there it is. You know, you've got Esther, Job, and then Psalms. Esther's just a short 10 chapters, and as her story comes to a conclusion, we read this in chapter 9 and verse 19. Therefore the Jews of the villages who dwelt in the unwalled towns celebrated the 14th day of the month of Adar with gladness and feasting as a holiday and for sending presents to one another. The 14th day of the month of Adar is a feast for the Jews called Purim. It's a feast of gladness and celebration. It's a remembrance for the Jews of how God can make dramatic reversals. The Book of Esther is a book, a story about dramatic reversals. God is sovereign and can turn what Satan means for evil into good. Think of what happened to Joseph when he got sold into slavery by his brothers. And then, what was it, a decade or two later, he was allowed to save his family from famine in a dramatic reversal. We read about that. You read him talking here. But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. He's talking to his brothers in order to bring it about as it is this day to save many people alive. So God is a God of dramatic reversals. And the celebration of Purim is a celebration of dramatic reversal. It's the story of Esther. It's the story of Mordecai and Haman. It's a story of the very king of Persia and his queen, Vashti. The timing is the 5th century in Persia. Now, Persia is what we would call the modern-day Iran. It's a story of God delivering the Jews from an anti-Semitic monster. See, before there was a Hitler, before there was a Hamas, before there was a Hezbollah, there was this character named Haman, who became just as Satan-inspired and dedicated to the destruction of the Jewish people. Even to this day, the country of Iran talks openly about wiping Israel off the map. It's a direct quote from the previous president, Ahmad Ahmadinejad, or whatever his name is. This new president, I think, should take 30 minutes and sit down with the Bible and read the book of Esther. It might be a real wake-up call for him. Be good for him. I doubt he's going to do it because the book of Esther is not in the Quran, so it's not likely to happen. That's too bad for him because it would teach him a valuable lesson. The celebration of Purim, as I said, is a celebration of the story of Esther, the story of God working behind the scenes. It's actually God working in disguise. It shows how God works through circumstances like we would never even be able to perceive. Sometimes the disguise that God works under, we call coincidence. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes, what appears to us to be coincidence is in fact God working in disguise in those situations. Sometimes people have called it providence. Our founding fathers called it providence, and they wrote about it many times in the documents that we see as they were founding this country. But many years ago, I heard a pastor coin a phrase about this providence, about this coincidence, and he called it God incidence. God incidence. Not coincidence, but God incidence. So when you see a coincidence that you believe God has had a hand in, maybe we don't call it coincidence. Maybe we use his word, God incidence. I'm going to use that word today. The story of Esther is certainly a story of God incidence. God working in disguise to work out his sovereign purpose. Fact is, one of the ways that the Jews celebrate Purim is they take their kids and they dress them in costumes. Have a costume party. They take their kids and dress them in disguise. Why? Because they recognize that in the story of Esther, in how God saved the Jews in the story of Esther, that God worked in disguise. He worked behind the scenes, controlling the circumstances in their favor. Now, I don't want us to get superstitious. I'm not superstitious. As the guy said on The Office, I'm not even a little stitious. Right? The fact is that everything that happens comes from one of four sources: God, Satan, choice, and chance. Everything that happens to us happens from one of those four things: God, Satan, choice, and chance. It takes discernment to know which one it is. And many times, we don't know. But we don't want to get superstitious about it. But the point that I want to make today, though, is that sometimes what appears to be just chance or coincidence is sometimes God disguising his sovereign work. God incidence. Now in Purim, the Jews came together in the synagogue and they would read the whole book of Esther. Now today's not Purim, and even if it was, and even if we were celebrating it, which we don't because we're not Jews, we aren't going to do that. You can read the book on your own. It's a short 10 chapters, so go for it. But we are going to look at the story today. Before we discuss the story, though, I want to bring to mind a couple of things that stand out overall about the book. First of all, there are no miracles in the book, per se. You know, not supernatural in that sense. Rather than out-and-out miracles, the story of Esther is all about the working of circumstances. If one could call it a miracle, it would be a miracle of timing. It's all about God showing his absolute guiding hand and sovereignty. You know, sometimes God thunders down and splits a sea. Sometimes he works God incidents. Another interesting thing about the book of Esther is that God is not referred to even once in the entire book. That's right. You can look through it. He is totally in the background, working in disguise and bringing about His will. And if you really read it and imagine it happening, it's kind of a comedy of sorts. Mm-hmm. It wasn't funny to Haman at the end, but the boomerang effect of a lot of these circumstances is hilarious when you think about it. You could make a sitcom out of the thing. It's funny how Satan can throw darts at us and God can make them just turn and smack him in the head. As I was thinking about it, I thought about that AFV video, you know, with the airplanes, and I went to put it right in the slide, but it wouldn't go, so I just flip over here and watch this. Sometimes, you know, the devil tries to throw things at us. But, you know, if we're faithful, God just causes them to fly right on around and smack him in the back of the head. And sometimes I think it's got to be frustrating to be Satan, and that makes me smile. Think of all the testimonies that you have heard that start out with something awful that was either going to happen or was feared it was going to happen, or it did happen, and by the end of the testimony, it's just plain funny how everything just kind of worked out and you could see the hand of God. It's a divine comedy of sorts. We can think things are so bleak, and then at the end, we can see how it wasn't really bleak at all, but how it was just God setting things up just the way He wanted them to be, to deliver something wonderful. When we read it correctly, the book of Esther is really a faith-building exercise on steroids. Here's some background. As I said, this takes place in Persia, which is modern-day Iran. The timing is about 100 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. It occurs during the reign of King Ahasuerus, as the Bible calls him. History refers him as King Xerxes I. Now, I don't know why history refers to him as King Xerxes I, but the Bible refers to him as Ahasuerus. I would assume it's some sort of translation issue, but I didn't look into it. But anyway, it's the same dude. What you need to know is about 30 years prior to King Ahasuerus, a small, maybe 30 people or so, were allowed by that king back into Jerusalem to try to revive it. So the point is, the vast majority of the Jews lived in Persia, and only that small number had returned to what was once Jerusalem, which was also in the Persian Empire. Now, Persia was a world-dominating power. At the time that the book of Esther, Persia was at the height of that power, at the height of their splendor and influence. The military had crushed all opposition. It was indeed world dominance. And it was in this environment that the Jews found a way to integrate and live among them. They made themselves a pretty good life, in spite of having to live with all the paganism of the Persian culture. But guys, long before Hitler, the devil was plotting his final solution, what we call his final solution, to wipe out all the Jews. remember now that the Messiah, this was before the Messiah came, and the Messiah was prophesied to come from where? From the tribe of Judah. So, Satan didn't know who exactly he was going to come from, but he knew it would be from that tribe. And if he could wipe out the whole tribe, he could thwart God's plan. See, Satan can read. And those things were written down at this point. So, in 487 BC, King Assuerus ascended to the throne. Now, 3 years later, he's enjoying the height of his empire. And we read in chapter 1 and verse 3, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants. The powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the provinces being before him. When he showed the riches of the glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. So basically what King Assuerus decided to do was to have a party. You know, pagans love to party. You know, everything's all good, enemies are crushed, the money's flowing in, you know, so let's just celebrate. Now, at that time, there was 127 provinces in the Persian Empire. And there was a prince over each province. So there was 127 princes. And King Assuerus called all 127 of these princes back to Susa, the capital city, to party at the palace and have a feast. They were to feast and display the wealth of the empire. Now this party lasted for 6 months. 6 months of debauchery. And that's basically what it was. It was a pagan, drunken time of debauchery. Now, even at the end of this party, at the end of the 6 months, he invited the whole city to the palace for a week-long drunk fest. But anyway, it wasn't but 7 days into this party, into this six-month mess, that King Assuerus sent for his wife, and the Bible says for her to show her beauty to the king's guests. Now, the Bible doesn't fill in all the gaps, but I just want you to, you know, you got to start to imagine what's going on here and think about this for a moment. Here is this giant drunken party going on with 127 princes. Now, these are pagans now. The Bible says that she was to show up with her crown to show her beauty. Now, I think Queen Vashti knew what that meant. That probably her crown was the only thing she was going to end up wearing. And she wasn't in any mood to go parade herself around in front of 127 drunk princes. Now, we don't get much information on this, but you got to understand that whatever it was that she was summoned by the king to do, she perceived as much worse than what she risked by disobeying him. And she didn't come. Now, this created a real crisis within the court of the king, because this was a pagan, male-dominated society. You think our society now is male-dominated. You don't understand what male domination means. Okay? This king was disobeyed by a woman in front of all the leaders of his provinces. This could not stand. If she could say no to the king, then what does that say about his sovereignty? That's one problem. Second problem is if it got out that she said no to the king, that this woman would say no to her man, then it would give rise to all sorts of women starting to say no to the men over them. Now, they couldn't have that. These women had just go out of control, they thought. Something has to be done. So what they did was they all met together and they decided, hey, we're going to strip her of her position as queen. And they decided to replace her with a new one. Now anybody that's heard this story or even watched the VeggieTale knows all of that. But we're going to take a turn now from what you might expect as we move through this. Most teachers, preachers if you will, whatever, don't have really the guts to tell you the truth. The fact is that much of the Old Testament really should be considered R-rated for violence and sexual content. You know, the process of finding a new queen has no godly attributes whatsoever within the Persian Empire. These were pagans, and the truth of the matter is that this was a vile process. This was no civilized beauty contest that they brought these women to with, you know, a talent session and a pose and presentation session and, you know, the evening gowns and all that. No. Here's how it worked. What happened was they sent men out to all of the empire of Persia, not just Susa, and they found the most beautiful virgin girls that they could find. And they were basically abducted and brought to the palace at Susa. They were brought into the harem of the virgins. And there they went through a 12-month beauty treatment and preparation for the king. They were basically trained how to, well, behave, if you will, with the king. After 12 months of teaching and preparation, each member of the harem of virgins was given a summons. And when it was their turn to have their night with the king, if you get my drift. This wasn't a first date with a dinner and a movie and a kiss on the cheek goodnight. This was a summons to the bedchambers of the king. And after that night, they never went back to the harem of virgins, for obvious reasons. Instead, they were moved over to another harem on the other side of the palace, the harem of the concubines. And there they stayed until perhaps the king might summon them again at some point. And this nastiness is exactly what happened to Esther. It is what she had to endure. Esther 2, verse 14. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of whoever, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Okay, so keep that in mind, that that's how the process worked. It was through this system that they would find a new queen. Now, among the Jews, there was a court official named Mordecai. He had some mid-level post, I don't know what it was. But Esther was his cousin. Esther's parents died when she was a young girl, and Mordecai was much older, probably 20 years or more older, and was her cousin. And so what he did was he adopted her and raised her as his own child. And although a cousin, because of the age difference, he was really more like an uncle or a stepdad to her. So now we have Mordecai, a Jew, in the court of the king, and Esther in the harem of the concubines. Okay? And in the interest of time here, I'm just going to say Esther was chosen to be, by the king, to be the new queen. Okay, so Esther's chosen. And right in the middle of this debased culture and nastiness, God was at work. A Jew was now the queen of Persia. And nobody knew it. Not even King Ahasuerus knew that she was a Jew. Because you see, Mordecai was smart enough that when Esther was taken and brought into the palace, he instructed her that she should keep the fact that she is a Jew to herself. She didn't call Mordecai uncle or dad or anything like that, any familial name like that, not even cousin. It was more like teacher or something like that. So nobody knew that Esther was a Jew. All right, so now usually one would go on and tell the story of Esther and how she was able to save her people by being faithful. And that's a great story, and that's a great lesson of the book of Esther. And if you want that lesson, when we're done, go watch the VeggieTale. You'll get it. Okay? It's a lesson about honoring God and doing the right thing no matter what the consequences are. And that's a good lesson. But what I want to do is I want to focus today on this character named Haman. I want you to see this story through Haman's eyes. And in this way, I think you'll see that it becomes somewhat a divine comedy. A comedy of God incidents. Haman was one of the 127 princes over the 127 provinces. But through some means that we don't know about, Haman was able to wiggle his way into becoming head over all the other provinces, over the other princes. He was kind of like a prime minister. You know, he was the number two guy under the king. A part of this position in the high court was that everyone, by king's decree, was to pay homage to Haman, to the king's number two man. They would bow to him like they would any idol or a god. In Esther chapter 3, it says, "And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai, the Jew, would not bow or pay homage." So in this pagan culture, no one had a problem with this command from the king. They did it, except Mordecai. He knew God's law and was not about to bow to a man as if he were God, no matter what the consequence was. He was just like his Jewish brothers years before that, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who would not bow. Remember that story? But you know, at first, Haman wasn't even really aware of Mordecai's, insistence not to bow. You got to understand, this was a large governmental court with all these princes and such, and Mordecai was just a mid-level clerk. Soon, though, somebody came to Haman and said, "Hey, you know, there's this one fella Mordecai who refuses to bow to you." Now, I wonder who came and whispered in this guy's ear to go say something to Haman about this. Well, it looks like to me like the devil's trying to launch one of those airplanes. And I think it's going to swing around. The guy comes and says, "You know, he's one of these Jews. And they're funny that way. They just have this one God. You know, they won't accept any of our gods. They just have their one God. They're hard-headed, and they won't bow to any God but their own God." Now, a guy like Haman obviously has an ego probably the size of Texas, and he got enraged over this. It says so in verse 5. "When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage, Haman was filled with wrath." Filled with wrath. That's one way to put it. Enraged probably would be a better word. He wanted to lay hands on him right then and there. But then Haman remembered that Mordecai was part of a much larger group of people. And this demonic thing began to enter into his mind. He was Satan-inspired to not just take care of Mordecai and have him executed. No, that was too small for a big guy, a big important man like, you know, Haman. I'm Haman. How dare this man not bow to me? And you mean there's more of them? No, I'm going to make sure they're all put to death. I'll show them who they're to bow to. See, that's a puffed up, evil man. And just like Hitler later on, Haman came up with his final solution as well. And so to choose a date for when he would have this thing done, he went before his gods and he cast lots. Now, lots in Hebrew, or lot in Hebrew, is pur. Lots, plural, is Purim. And that's where the Jews got the name for this holiday of theirs. Now, when he cast the lots, the lot fell to the 13th day of Adar, which happened to be 11 months ahead. So he had 11 months to plan and scheme and prepare for how he was going to destroy these Jews. So what he did was he went before the king and he used subterfuge on the king. You know, he lied to him by not telling him everything. Okay? He didn't tell him who they were, but he said that there were certain people among your empire, king, that, you know, we've conquered many nations and we've brought many ethnicities into our culture, but it's come to my attention, king, that there are these people that are not like the other people. They're different, and they aren't integrating into our empire. They're causing trouble. Because they refuse to worship our gods and they refuse our laws. They keep their own law that they have. And I think this, king, I think this is a threat to the empire and we should take care of this problem before it gets out of hand. And you know, as your loyal servant, Haman, I'll even finance the whole operation. Well, he had a reason for that. He put up millions of ounces of silver to finance the thing. Why? So that he could plunder. Oh, that he would be able to receive the plunder and all of the personal assets of all the Jews. Not only was it a hideously evil thing, he was also trying to profit from it. So using this lying tongue, he seduced King Assyrius into going along with it. So the king took off his signet ring and he gave it to Haman and he said, "Here, you've got my authority to execute this operation." So Haman wrote this proclamation, signed with the king's signet ring, that on the 13th day of Adar, in all the provinces of Persia, which included Jerusalem, that all were to rise up against the Jews and put them to death. Esther 4 verse 1. When Mordecai heard all that had happened, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went into the midst of the city. He cried out with a loud and bitter cry. You can imagine the reaction of the rest of the Jews as well. Esther heard of the decree and she asked Mordecai to put off his sackcloth and come see her. He refused, but he sent a note back to her that said, "Esther, don't think that you are going to escape this Holocaust just because you live in the palace. I know that when you came to the palace, I told you to be quiet about being a Jew. But now I'm telling you, speak up. Speak up." And what he said was, "Who knows? Perhaps you have come into the palace for just such a time as this." Mordecai had this he had this vision. He had this understanding of God incidents. He said, perhaps, maybe you're in the palace for just such a time as this. So Esther agrees to speak up and do what she can. But you have to get a little perspective on that as well. You can't think of King Ahasuerus and Queen Esther as this loving married couple running the kingdom as king and queen. It wasn't like that at all. Ahasuerus had a harem of women. Esther had the official position as queen, but it's not like she was his soulmate or something. In fact, she even said, I haven't seen him for 30 days. I haven't even seen him for 30 days. Because you see, there was a law. You didn't just sashay into the inner court uninvited. Wasn't done. Esther 4:11. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman that goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law: put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. All this was done in great pomp and circumstance. You had to be summoned by the king, and then when you were and you arrived, there were guards and stuff with trumpets, and you were heralded as you came in, and it was just a big to-do. It was all formal and laid out. And to be so presumptuous as to just come uninvited meant death, unless the king found favor with you and took his golden scepter and raised it, and the guards would halt from basically probably spearing them to death. But even in the face of death, she says, I'll do it, I'll go. Which is normally the big focus of the book of Esther. She says, I've been summoned, I haven't been summoned, but I'll go, and if I perish, I perish. Mordecai and Esther being faithful in the face of opposition is a big lesson of the book of Esther. But again, I want to get into the head of Haman a bit. And I want to see the God incidents work in this. Satan thinks he's directing this guy. But we're about to see the hand of God's sovereignty. So she goes uninvited with her life in the hands of the king, and he holds up his scepter and accepts her and says, what is it, Esther? What is it that you want? Because he knew that she was taking her life in her hands. So it must be important. What is it, Esther, that you want? Up to half of my kingdom, he says. It's just something they said. I don't know what would happen if anybody said, really? Okay, yeah, I'll take half. Yeah, right. Probably say, sure, you can have half. It'll just cost you half your head. Anyway. He said to her, what is it that you want, Esther? And so being wise, she said, I would like for you and Haman to come to a feast tomorrow that I have prepared in your honor. Now, the king undoubtedly knew that something was up. But he was gracious to Esther, and he said, okay, I'll accept your invitation. And he sent for Haman, so that Haman would know to come tomorrow to this feast that she was going to put on. So the next day at the banquet, and I'm sure it was well done, the queen put this whole thing together, and it was very enjoyable. But at one point the king, having sat back from his meal and drinking his wine, knowing that there was something that she really wanted, she didn't really want just to have this banquet and honor him. So he asked her, he finally came out, what is your petition? It shall be granted you. What is your request? Up to half my kingdom, it shall be done. Crazy king, here he goes again with his half a kingdom thing. But how Esther responds is really quite interesting. she says. And Esther answered and said, "My petition and request is this. If I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, then let the king and Haman come to a banquet tomorrow, which I will prepare for them." This banquet was great, but man, I'm going to outdo myself tomorrow. "Come again tomorrow, and then I will do as the king has said." Now, I have always found that fascinating. Why? Because the king finally says, "Okay, Esther, I know something's on your mind. What do you want? What is it that you really want?" But rather than saying, surprisingly, she says, "Well, what I want is for you to come to another banquet tomorrow." What was so different about tomorrow? She didn't invite anybody else. She just said, I want to do a banquet tomorrow, and I want you and Haman to come. It doesn't make any sense. She has the king there. She has his attention. She has Haman there. The king is asking, "What do you want, Esther?" Why didn't she just tell him? Why didn't she say, "I want you to spare my people and expose Haman and get it done right then and there"? I mean, from a human standpoint, everything's all set up. Tomorrow's not going to be any different. Let's just knock this thing out today and get it done. Why risk him saying, "No, you know, I got plans tomorrow"? Why risk that? Physical perception would say, let's just take the bull by the horn. We got the opportunity right now. Let's get this done. But you know, when you think about it, and I think this is to Esther's credit, that not only was she faithful enough to do this hard thing in the face of death, coming into the court like she did, but she is also obedient enough and she's plugged in enough to God to have patience and wait on God's timing, to do what He said to do when He says to do it. I think there's a tremendous lesson there. I think God put something on her heart to where she was like, "This isn't right." I don't think she planned another banquet. I don't think she planned two banquets. I think she's there, and I think something just happened in her that this isn't right. And she listened to God, and she said, when He asked her, "Well, what do you want?" She says, "No, I want you to come tomorrow." And by doing this, by being plugged in, by waiting on God and listening to Him, it sets up some of the most awesome God incidents that you will find in the Bible. And it's that divine comedy that I'm trying to share with you. And to do so, we've got to get into the head of Haman. You got to understand that this old boy was on top of the world. Everything in his life was just coming up rosy. He's second to the king. He's got all the other princes bowing to him when he comes in the room. "I've got riches. I'm invited into the inner chamber to have private meals with the king and the queen 2 days in a row." Now, when you've got an ego like Haman and things are going that well, what do you think he's going to do? He's going to share it. He's going to start bragging a little bit. You know, he wants to gather his friends together and family and tell them just how good he's got it, how great he is, and elevate himself just a little bit more. And so he's on his way home to do just that. He's called all his friends and his family together. And he's all puffed up and, "Man, everything's going well. And I'm on my way home and I'm going to tell everybody how good everything's going." And then who's he run into? Mordecai. And Mordecai won't bow. And it just enrages this guy. Here he has all his friends coming, so he doesn't have time to deal with it. So he has to ignore it, and he goes on to his friends and his family. And when he gets to this little gathering for his bragging, so he can tell everybody how rich and powerful he's become, he's all of a sudden struck by this thorn in his side, Mordecai. He laments to his friends how this guy has just dishonored him. Everything's going so great. You know, I got all this good stuff going on, but here's this one guy that just won't bow. And he's just consumed with this rage that he can't even enjoy all the rest of the good things that are happening to him because he just can't get Mordecai out of his mind and these Jews. And so his wife responds. He says, Mordecai, or Haman, you know, just make a big gallows and hang the guy. You know, you're the prime minister. You can do whatever you want. Make a huge gallows. I don't know. Make it 75 feet tall. Make a spectacle out of it. Make an example out of this Mordecai. You're the prime minister. You know, all you got to do is build this gallows. You can go in the morning. Go in the morning and meet with the king. Get permission. And you can get this guy hung so that in the afternoon you can be at peace, you can have this off your mind, and you can go into the inner room with the king and the queen and enjoy the banquet and all of that. And it'll be nice. You can bask in the glory of it, knowing that this Mordecai has taken care of. Haman says, you know, I like that. That's a good idea. So he commands right away that the gallows be built. Now this is Haman's plan. It's got a big day tomorrow. Okay? I'm going to get to the office early, and I'm going to take care of Mordecai in the morning. And then I'm going to be free to enjoy my banquet with the king and the queen. I have all that weight off my shoulder. It's going to be a great day. Can't wait. But then what happens? God incidents kicks in. Oh, this is good. First, Esther was moved in such a way as to delay a day. She was just moved. It's just God working. And then that night, God gets in King Ahasuerus' head. It's in his head. Esther 6:1. That night, the king could not sleep. So, one was commanded to bring the book of the record of the Chronicles, that they be read before the king. Now, if you've ever had God wake you up in the middle of the night, you know it's pretty much useless to try to get back to sleep until you deal with whatever it is that God woke you up about. And I'm sure this king tried everything. God, you know, had put some severe insomnia on this dude. And so he thought about, how am I going to get to sleep? How am I going to sleep? I know. I'll call for the records of the government. I'll have that boring drivel read to me, and that will surely put me to sleep. That'll do it. So he had somebody come and read the records of the Chronicles to him. So somebody came and began to read. God incidents. Now, I have to backtrack some to explain what happened next. Back in chapter 2, at one point, Mordecai overheard a plot to assassinate the king. He told Esther about it, who then went to King Ahasuerus and said, Mordecai has told me about this plot to assassinate you that he overheard, and he wanted me to come and tell you about it. And so she did, and he heard it, and he investigated, had his guards go out and take care of the situation, and an assassination against King Ahasuerus was thwarted because of Mordecai. Now, I forgot to tell you that earlier. So now we're back to the bedchamber, okay, where someone is trying to read the records of the king so that he can drift off to sleep. But by God incidents and perfect timing, as only God can do, as dawn is breaking, the servant gets to the part in the record about the foiled plot. The king hears this and asks, well, what was done for Mordecai to honor him? And they look through the thing and they said, well, it doesn't look like anything was done. And the king says, well, that's no good. This guy, Mordecai, saved my life. And nothing was done for him? We've got to correct this at once. And so it's dawn and it's early and, you know, he's like, well, is there anybody even here? Is there anybody here yet? Go out in the inner court and see if there's anybody here that can help me take care of this. So the eunuch walks outside and he looks, and oh, it's Haman. He's come in early today so that he can take care of his problem. And so the eunuch comes back in. He says, well, King, Haman's here. He's come in early for some reason. And so the king says, oh, good, good, good. That's great. Summons him in. So he summons Haman into the bedchamber. And you can get an idea. You know, the king's sitting on the edge of his bed. He comes in, you know, and he says, hey, Naaman, what should a person do? What should I do to give honor to someone whom I wish to give honor to? Now, you got to understand there's a lot happening here. The king couldn't sleep. He found out Mordecai saved him, and nothing was done about it. Now, there's gallows being finished up outside. Haman's coming in early to ask permission to hang Mordecai. But the king wants to deal with this oversight in honoring the one that saved his life. And just so happens that Haman is there early for him to come in and counsel. And so he thinks, oh great, Haman's here. Come on in. I'll talk to him about it. And so we get to Esther, verse 6. Esther 6, verse 6. So Haman came in, and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman, his ego, he thinks in his heart, well, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? What an ego! He just assumes that the king is referring to him. He's on top of the world. So he thinks, what shall be done? What would I want the king to do for me? I mean, for the one that he wishes to honor. So he answers in verse 8, let the royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of the one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Oh my goodness. Haman needed not money or anything else. He just wanted even more honor and be more puffed up. If this was a movie, you'd have a huge laugh as you see the look on Haman's face when the king says, that sounds great. Make it so. I want you to go do exactly that. Don't miss a thing. The horse, the robe, the whole bit. And I want you to go do it for Mordecai the Jew. And Haman's face goes, what? Really? I've got not Mordecai. I have to lead him? Because not 5 minutes before, Haman was coming to ask the king to hang him. And now he has to take this same man, which he hates, and put the royal robe on him, put him on the horse, on the king's own horse, and lead him through the streets and shout, "Here's what's to be done to the man to whom God, whom the king wants to honor." It must have killed him to go through that. Verse 12 says that afterward, Haman rushed home weeping with his head covered. It's hilarious how it affected his flesh. And so after lamenting just a little bit to his wife about all these awful things that happened to him all morning, the eunuchs show up. And guess what? It's time for the banquet. Now poor Haman, the morning just hasn't just quite turned out right for him the way he wanted it. And not only is the vile Mordecai still alive, but in a gigantic twist of dramatic reversal, he had to go out in public and honor the man that he so despised. And this is his state of mind as he goes into this banquet for the second time. Oh, what one day makes in the timing of God. He shows up and they have their banquet. And I can just see Haman sitting there at the table, pushing his food around. He doesn't have any appetite. You know, this day is not going the way I wanted it to go. And once again, the king comes after the dinner and he's eating, he's drinking his wine. He says, "Okay, Esther, now I know that there's something, this has got to be big. There's something on your mind." And he throws that, "I'll give you half my kingdom" thing at her. And he says, "What is it, Esther?" And now she decides to lay it on him. She's got peace with it. God incidents has everything primed and everything in place. And she says, chapter 7, verse 5, "For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss." So King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he? Who is he? Where is he? Who would dare presume to do such a thing?" Esther looked at him. He looked at Haman. And he looked back at the king. And he said, "It is this Haman that has done this evil thing." Oh man, can you imagine? All of the pieces start suddenly coming together for King Ahasuerus. And he figured out what was going on. And Haman looked at him and he just started shivering in his boots. Because King Ahasuerus got enraged. So mad that it's his very second in command that has deceived him. And that it's his queen that has to bring this to his attention. And he's so mad, he's so torn about this, all this, that he gets up from the table and he says, "I gotta get some air." And so he goes out into the garden and he's out there trying to clear his head. Now that plane has really circled around now for Haman. And it's inches from knocking him in the back of the head. And so he knows the only thing he can do is duck. Right? It's like that guy on the video. He kept ducking. So in order to try to duck, what he does, he knows the only thing he can save him is mercy from Esther. So he goes and he begins to beg for mercy. Now you got to get this picture. Okay, I want to paint this picture for you. They're in this inner room. They're in this inner court. And you got Queen Esther laying on this couch being all queenly. Right? She's laying there in her queenliness. And Haman is just distraught. He's just overcome with, you know, he saw, you know, he's been called out. He saw how the king reacted. He knows he's a dead man unless he can convince her to have mercy. So he he comes at the queen, just shaking and trying to beg for mercy and get down on one knee or something, and he trips. And he falls across the queen. And in tremendous God incidents, in the Divine Comedy, that's the exact moment that the king walks back in the room. And he's like, "What? What are you doing? I found out that you've deceived me, and then I see that now you try to abduct my queen in my own house? It's like a TV sitcom. Here he is insulting his queen. He's like, what the heck? He's going berserk. Now, that's all happening. Now, over in the other side of the room, you know, there's this eunuch. This eunuch. And he's standing. And he's watching all this unfold. And apparently he's standing by the window. And all this is happening. And King Assyrus is just going berserk. And he's out of his mind with anger. And the eunuch is standing there and he looks out the window and he says, "Oh, look, gallows." Can you see it all coming together? This king is enraged. He leaves to cool down. He comes back in and Haman is laid out across his queen. The king goes out of his mind and the eunuch looks out a window and says, "Hey, look, gallows." And aren't those the ones that Haman had built for Mordecai? And the king goes, "What? That is enough." And so in the most comedic, dramatic, and ironic reversals there could be, Assyrus commands, "Hang Haman on those gallows." The blood, just the Bible says, just drained out of Haman's face. And as they're dragging him out, the king says, "Wait a minute, stop. Take that ring off of his finger and bring it to me." And he brings the ring. They take it off of Haman and they drag him out and hang him, and they bring the ring back to King Assyrus, and guess who he puts it on? Mordecai. Mordecai. The very man that Haman was trying to kill that morning now has his position in the royal court. Glory to God who works in the lives, guys, of those that obey him. Now, just real quickly to finish the story, you need to understand that they had a law in Persia that no law could be repealed. Once it was commanded, it stood fast. But what they could do is put forth another law. So the king had Mordecai issue a new proclamation on that day that everyone that was supposed to rise up on the 13th day of Adar against the Jews, that the Jews were now to defend themselves, and that the Jews would have the full force and effect and strength of the Persian military. So, look what it says in the last chapter of verse 9, of chapter 9, or chapter 8 rather. "And in every province and city, wherever the king's command and decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness, a feast and a holiday. Then many of the people of the land became Jews, because of fear of the Jews fell upon them." You catch that? In another divine and dramatic reversal of God incidents, not only were the Jews spared, but many were converted. Many more were converted. Their numbers grew. I said the book of Esther at the beginning can grow our faith like on steroids. And do you see why? If we would just allow God to work in our circumstances, to be patient and trusting that He will work things out, we would see His hand in our lives. We would see God incidents in our lives. We all say that we want God's will. We all say that we want the best that God has for us. But I'm going to ask you right now, hear me. Are you willing to wait for it? Are you willing to get where God is leading us in the timing that He has for it? Are we willing to sacrifice for it like Esther believed she was doing, risking her very life? But as you think through the lessons of Esther, I don't want you to forget the lesson of Haman. See, Haman was doing things his way. And for a time, it worked. I mean, it not only worked, it seemed to work great. He was prime minister. He was a prince over all the princes. He had elevated as high as he could go. It would appear to anyone watching that his way was working. All of us can point to lots of people that are doing well while living in a cesspool of sin. And in our lives, we have things that we're not doing right. Yet we don't see the consequences right away, so we think we're getting away with it. And that's the evil deception and the lesson we can take from Haman. Because Satan wants us to believe that his way works. And sometimes it does, for a season. He told Adam and Eve that if they ate of that tree, they'd die. Well, they ate of it and they didn't die, for a season. And then they died. See, I believe God. I believe that if they hadn't eaten that tree and ate of the other one, that they would have lived forever. I believe it because that's what God said. Now, who do you believe? Really? Really? Are you deceived in some of the choices that you are making right now in your life because they appear to be working? Even though you know that God says to do it different. Do you believe Him enough to change something that is working just because God says to? The lesson of the book of Esther is not just Esther and Mordecai's faithfulness, but also the lesson of Haman. If you have things in your life that you know need changing, you better do it before that airplane makes its complete loop and whacks you upside the head. The question is, do you have faith to persist in doing good even when you have experienced that doing it Satan's way has seemed to work for you in the past? That's a mouthful. Don't ever forget that we sow what we reap, but there are seasons between the sowing and the reaping. You can sow weeds for a while before they sprout, but they're going to sprout. Haman's life seemed to be perfect and working the way that he wanted it to. But it didn't last for him, and it won't last for anyone else that tries it. There is wisdom there, and much for all of us to meditate on and apply to our lives and to the decisions that we are making right now. We need to have faith that God will always work things out if we are faithful to follow His ways. Look at all of that circumstance that God was able to completely direct. God incidents can work for you, or, like Haman, it can work against you. Romans 8:28 says, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose." And this scripture is cited a lot, but you know, it doesn't apply to Haman, does it? People want it to be blanket for everyone, but it's not. He says He works, God incidents. He works things for good to those who love God. Who are those who love God? You know. I'm not even going to read them to you. You read them yourself. The lesson of the faithfulness of Esther and Mordecai is a good one. But don't miss the fact that, like Haman, God incidents can hit you in the back of the head too. When you persist in not loving God and not honoring Him by doing the things that He says. If you love me, keep my commandments. It is those that God says He will work God incidents to make all things happen for good to those that love Him. Amen?
Amen.